Welcome to the Zoe Routh Leadership Podcast, your source of strategies and insights to make you a better leader. Influence, improve, inspire.
Hi, this is Zoe Routh, and you know what? I have what I'm a most favoritist of peoples in the whole wide world on the podcast and webcast today. It's Peter Cook. And Pete is a speaker and mentor, my mentor too, and a best-selling author of, get this, 8 freaking books under his belt. And these include The New Rules of Management, which we're going to talk about explicitly today, The Thought Leader's Practice, and The E-Myth Bookkeeper. And notice this name drop, he co-authored with Michael E. Gerber of the E-Myth fame. So he's a bigwig. He is also the CEO of Thought Leaders, the Dean of Thought Leaders Business School, which I've been a participant and proud member for the last 3 and a bit years. He is a third Dan black belt in Aikido, an Ishaya monk, and we'll hopefully talk a little bit about that, and the proud dada of Scarlett and Emily. Welcome, Mr. Peter Cook.
Welcome. I'm just going to actually switch my router.
You're switching your router, I think. Your connection is crap. Did you just switch your router? Is that what you just did?
I did, and now I should be better and not freezing so much.
Okay, cool.
So from the top, thank you so much for having me, Zoe. It's an absolute honor and a pleasure to be chatting to you on your very own podcast. How cool is that? You've got a podcast.
It is pretty cool. It's been going for just over a year now, and it's becoming one of my favorite modalities in terms of sharing and thinking major concepts that help us progress in our leadership and our work. Because I've been interviewing some amazing folks and learning heaps myself along the way. And I love listening to podcasts. I put them on.
Over a year.
Yeah, over a year. Yeah, I think this is episode. You're surprised.
It's taken you a year to invite me on.
And there's the little dig. Yep, you are episode 68. So I've talked to 67. Wow. Oh, not quite 67 other people because some of them were just with me. But
congratulations. Yeah. That's prolific.
Thanks, Pete. So it's prolific and productive, which is a very nice segue. Thank you very much.
Yeah, nice alliteration too.
Okay, so we're here to talk about the new rules of management, otherwise known as implement, and you are the master of implementation. It's one of your foundational pieces for your thought leadership. In other words, how to get people to get stuff done. So you might have lofty aspirations, but how do you buckle down and actually deliver on that? So what led you to getting obsessed with implementation?
Yeah, I've been reflecting on this for, I think, a week since you sent me through an email, and I'm not actually sure. And I was thinking, how could anybody actually not be obsessed with implementation? But the idea, so you talk about teaching other people how to do that and helping other people get stuff done, but it starts with me. And how do I get stuff done? But I think anybody who wants to be successful in anything has to have a bit of an obsession about actually getting things done and getting things finished. And so I'm not sure where it actually came from, but it's been there for a while. And I guess for me it was obsession about how do I get things done, and coming from, if I'm going to be successful at anything, that's something I'm going to need to master.
It's surprising how many people get stuck though. You know, I talk to, I have a lot of clients and they want accountability and they want breakthroughs in their blocks and so on. And they're not any less ambitious than any other people. They just find themselves not doing stuff. So in your work around this, what have you found are the mistakes that people make when it comes to implementation and productivity?
The biggest one is that we blame ourselves.
Oh.
So we think that productivity, implementation, success even, is internal. And when I don't get something done, there's something wrong with me. So I say, all right, I want to get fit and I want to exercise. And I join a gym and then I don't go. And then my internal conversation is, I'm weak, I'm ill-disciplined, my character, there's something wrong with my character, there's something wrong with me, and here's more evidence for why I can't do it. And I think that it's actually much more about what we put around ourselves. We're not designed to implement long-term projects.
What do you mean by that?
So, I mean, I designed in inverted commas. Like if you look at how we've evolved over hundreds of thousands of years to survive in the savannah. So that's what we're good at. Like that's what our biology is set up for, our neuro, our brain, our neurochemistry is really good for dealing with a tiger crossing our path. A whole lot of things are going to kick into place to help you. If you're walking down the street and a tiger walks out of shop, your adrenaline's going to get pumped in, your digestion will slow down, your fight or flight response is going to be there straight away. That's what we're designed to do, not to run a 12-month project to get fit.
Right.
I think of it a bit like I'm a child of the 80s.
Yeah, me too, bro.
And Wednesday nights, my mum, she was studying, she's a psychiatrist now, and she was studying child psychiatry when I was a kid, and Wednesday nights she was at university doing that. So it was, that was the night that me and my two brothers and my dad were on our own, and it was A-team night.
So we love the A-team.
Dun, dun, dun. So we always watched the A-team on Monday night, and the, for any of your listeners who aren't familiar, the plot was the same every week. Essentially, they would need to rescue some, typically a damsel in distress. They would get caught by the bad guys and get locked up in a shed with all the bad guys on the outside with the damsel and the machine guns. And what you'd want in that case, ideally, is a tank.
Oh, yeah. Bulldoze out of there.
Of course, there's never a tank sitting in the shed. There's always a tractor, some welding equipment in the corner, some steel plates, some hydraulic gear, and a pile of watermelons. And so what they would do is weld the metal onto the front of the tractor, hook up the hydraulic gear, grab the pile of watermelons, then come blasting out of the shed in this tractor, shooting watermelons at the bad guys so that nobody actually dies, and rescuing the damsel in distress and heading off into glory. And it's, I think of ourselves a bit like that. We've got to hack all these things on around ourselves to get better at this. So rather than blaming ourselves for not being ideal for this, it's better to say, all right, kind of accept this is not what I'm designed for. So what are the things that I can put around myself? What are the external structures that are going to make me better at implementing things, at getting long-term projects fulfilled? And the one you mentioned, accountability, is one of those. External accountability is an external structure that can help you do that.
Okay, so poo-pooing accountability is not the right thing to do.
Mm-mm.
By the way, is that a water bottle with little purple hearts on it? Is that like your daughter's water bottle?
I can't believe this is the second time in a week that I've got grief for this. They're not. They're little teardrops.
Okay.
It's a glass water bottle because Alessandra, our friend, has said I'm not allowed to drink out of plastic.
Okay.
She just bought a glass one and it's got little, but it's purple. And when I was at the road show last week, Matt also was hanging it on me. Purple. So I think I perhaps do need a more masculine water bottle.
Yep. Anyway, it's cute. I'm glad it's glass. That's good.
It is.
So an example of how to hack yourself to support yourself is by having resources that support your biology. And plastic is one of the things that is detrimental to your biology. So I have a BPF-free water bottle as part of my strategy.
Nice, so, nice link in. That's the way you brought that back. A little tenuous, but you got there.
So accountability. It's a useful thing. And if we're talking about like hacking the A-team and bolting things on and setting ourselves up to support so that getting ourselves out of the Kalahari Desert or the Sahara, wherever it is, I'm sure I would not survive more than a day in. I'd get fried and starve and whatever. In any case, I get your point, though. We're designed for survival, not for long-term plotting. When it comes to business
and
hacking,
not for thriving in an environment where our survival is now a given.
Yeah, that's right.
Or me or anyone listening to this, chances are we have shelter, we have food, we have clothing, like the basics are all taken care of.
Yep.
And now it's a whole different game that we haven't evolved for.
Yeah. So if you're designing the perfect ecosystem to support a professional who's going to be uber productive, we've got accountability is one piece. What else is there, Pete?
There's projects. So actually creating a long-term project that has milestones and has outcomes and that's very specific. So rather than kind of nebulous long-term intents, a project, and I talk about projects that matter.
Mm.
So something, an outcome that's going to light you up.
Mm-hmm.
Another is the right support. So who are the people around you that are helping you, who are your mentors, who's on the team, so not doing it on your own. We're social animals. And the right frameworks, the right environment, the right physical environment, the right electronic environment, the right methodology.
Mm. So that's an interesting one. The fact that we're social animals, and I've been working a lot in the space of looking at remote workers who are the antithesis of that, basically. Yeah. So you're alone in your own work environment, and yet there's this need to be social. And Leah Martin, who I interviewed earlier, was talking about this is one of the struggles he has with his remote working force, is this fighting against loneliness piece. So in your experience, in getting the social context and getting the social support around you, what does that look like? And can it be adapted for remote workers?
Yeah, we had our, interestingly, last week, our team, which is, we've got people all over Australia and in the Philippines, and I've got people in Canada, and it's been a challenge for us too. And we had our first production day last week, where just for the day we got everybody who's in Australia together, and the overseas team dialed in on Zoom, kind of like this, and had a day that was just dedicated. It was dedicated to moving projects forward. So we called it a production day rather than a strategy day or a team day.
Okay.
But there was an enormous benefit in terms of the social side of things too. And it's something that I've realized I've kind of been remiss not doing up until now.
Bringing people together face to face, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've been reading Remote by the founder of 38 Signals, whose name has just escaped me.
It's not Eric Fried, is it? Or is it somebody else?
It's Fried, but I don't think it's Eric. But
okay.
The right person, yes. And let's sit on my bookshelf. No, I'm not going to. And, yeah, he runs a remote team as well and talks about some of the challenges with that. And it's a really good resource for anybody who's doing that, and it's something that we've decided is we're going to once a year bring everybody together for a few days.
Yeah.
And then do regular virtual work days together as well, where people who are co-located will come together and will be electronically linked up.
Okay. So it comes back to first principles. Like, we kind of just glossed over it so far, this projects that matter piece. You know, how do you know if it's a project that matters or whether it's just business as usual? What are the key qualifiers, if you like, for projects that matter?
Yeah, good question. For me, it's does it kind of make my heart sing a little bit? Like, can I get juiced about it? And there's in a business, we're going to have, you know, I think I talked to my team, there's tasks. So there are things that just here's a one-off thing to do, and then there's systems that we run continually, and then there's the projects, which are the new things that produce new outcomes. And as much as possible, I want to shift things kind of further have things systematized and easy, have the business as usual be easy to free up as much of my time and headspace for the projects as possible. So there's pushing things back. And then professionally, I think that the projects, one way to answer this question is, okay, when you look back in 10 years on your career, or what are the things that you're going to be proud of? What are the things that would make it to your resume? And I think a modern resume is much more about what are the projects that you've done, that you've accomplished, rather than, well, I had this accountability and this was my job description. What are the things you can look back and say, oh, well, when I was at Apple, I was part of the team that built the first iPod.
Rather than I was just at Apple from 2009 to 2015.
Yeah. And this was my job description, and these were the system, and essentially these are the systems that I followed.
Mm.
It's what did you create?
So do you think in the context of modern workplaces, I mean, you and I are thought leaders, we craft our own businesses and our own projects. Mm. For folks who are in corporate land,
yep.
I think there's still scope to pivot and to have a project-based approach to work?
I think it's critical. I think the more, if you're a, so the industrial model is somebody else has created a system and now you follow the system.
Mm.
And that's becoming obsolete. If it's a system, a computer's going to be able to do it, or somebody else, somewhere else will be able to do it cheaper, or both. And if that's all you're doing is following a procedure, even if it's a high-end procedure, if you're a doctor who's doing an operation following a system, at some point that won't need to be you anymore.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a pilot who's taking off following a process for how to take off an aeroplane, how to take off in an aeroplane, if you're an accountant following a procedure for how to do a tax return, if you're a lawyer following a procedure for how to create a contract, that's, you know, there's a lot of training that we've done to do those tasks, but it is still following a system.
Mm.
And in another 10 years or 20 years, that those jobs won't exist.
That's right. So business, like the business world, is attuned to that, or savvy people are attuned to that. What about the public service? What do you think is going to happen there?
I have no idea. So give me an example in the public service. That sounds very kind of broad.
It does. Okay. So let's say Department of Human Services, which is by all accounts very process oriented. So it's there to deliver services that support humans and social security and that kind of stuff. I think I'm just answering my own question as I'm speaking this. I can imagine that they will need to have projects on the go as well to adapt to the changes in society and to the political landscape.
Hmm.
I'm thinking more about the individual worker though. How can they take control of their workspace? I guess it's about lateral leadership and leadership upwards. Is that
and finding, kind of fighting for what's the bit that matters.
Oh, I like that.
So saying, okay, well, here's my whole job, and these are the regular things that happen that I need to stay on top of.
Yeah,
and these are the systems that I need to follow, and that's part of pretty much any role. But then Google's famous for their 20% time. They're saying, all right, here's workers can have, and it's not all of their workers, but workers can have 20% of their time to work on projects that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of doing that yourself, saying, okay, this is the stuff that matters and I'm going to fight to make space for that.
Yeah.
As well as doing whatever else I need to do.
Yeah. I like that. And the other thing that you write about in your book is this whole, you know, project approach to progress is that you recommend 90-day projects.
Yeah.
Why 90 days is my first question around that. Like, why not 62 days?
It feels like it's long enough to get something substantial done, but not so long that we can just put it off.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if it's a 12-month project to write a book, I can start that next week.
What, a year? Can't you just knock one off in 90 days, Pete?
Exactly. So rather than have it be 12 months to do it,
yeah,
I would say have a 90-day project. And the 90-day project might not be the final version of the book.
Right.
But there's much more traction in saying this is what I'm going to get done in the next 13 weeks.
Do you think people overestimate or underestimate what's possible in a 90-day block?
They overestimate.
Okay.
So people overestimate chronically what they can do in a week or in a month or in a quarter.
In a day also.
and in a day and in an hour and in a meeting and in everything except in a decade.
And then they underestimate what they do?
They underestimate what can get done in a decade.
Well, that's weird.
Yeah. But it's, you look back and do the mind experiment. You can look back on your last week and think, what are you frustrated that didn't happen?
Mm.
And look back at the last month.
Mm-hmm.
But then look at where you were 10 years ago.
How
old? Look at what you've done. Yeah.
I can't even remember how old I am. Okay.
But yeah, like 10 years ago, if we were having a conversation and saying you'd be running a podcast with 68 episodes and have written 3 books, and your last decade is extraordinary.
That's true. Yeah.
But it's not like each week or each month or each quarter feels like that.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. So just a leap of forward then. So, because often we do these visioning exercises, you know, 10 years, imagine yourself, and people have all these pie in the sky stuff. Really, we should encourage people to have pie in the sky stuff, because if you put it out there, it's likely that you can actually grow into that.
Yeah, I think definitely for a decade, by all means. And the risk is that you then kind of achievable and much smaller for the next 90 days.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So how we can let ourselves off the hook is to say, yeah, in 10 years I'm going for this big thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be so big that there's nothing you can hold yourself to account for.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because it's just too big, can't put your hands around it.
Yeah.
Okay. So you talk also about recommendation 90-day projects in your professional life. Get that. And 90-day projects in your personal life.
Mm.
How do you choose a project for your personal life? Like, is that like 90 days, lose 9 pounds or 9 kilos or whatever? Is that the kind of thing? Or is it, maybe
yeah,
I'm lacking imagination in this.
Well, it can be in whatever, yeah, if it's around health, whatever's important to you.
Yeah.
And part of it too is I use projects to create habits.
Yeah.
So for me now, going to the gym is a habit. I've got a personal trainer, so there's external accountability, but it's 3 times a week and it doesn't take much willpower anymore for that to happen.
Yeah.
And we'll still set projects like what do we want to achieve by when, what do I want to be able to lift, what are we trying to do.
Uh-huh.
But to actually get it going and like a 90-day project to get that habit up and running, and I'm saying, okay, this is a real intense focus for the next 90 days. I want to 13 weeks or 39 sessions at the gym by this date. Let me put it up, tick them off. I know that it's a risk that most people will join a gym and not go tell people about it. Like, what are all the things that I can do to give myself the best chance of that happening?
Yeah.
Like read the research, actually put the sessions in, like what day and what time am I going to go, pay my trainer so he's there. So that's in a way, that's a project that I'm looking to use to create a habit. But that can also be I'll have projects with my, you know, with my girls that can be, so one of my 8 books
You just had to put that in there, right? My 8 books compared to your 3. Pete's just gone off to find it on his bookshelf for those of you who are listening to the podcast instead of the video. And in the video, we have a great view of Pete's Mondo microphone. So before we started recording, it was like, who's got the biggest and bestest microphone? Pete wins.
He doesn't win trying to find the book.
Where's your project?
So this was a book that I... Okay, it's gone. So the book, which I can't find, is Catsville. I wrote a kid's book with Scarlett. So I was kind of joking, one of my books is just this kid's book.
Oh, you didn't put that in your bio.
That we only printed 30 copies of. But it's my favourite book. Like the ones that
it's printed. I love this story. So Scarlett was how old when you started this project?
2.
What? And 2?
Yeah, and she said she wanted to write a book with me. And I said, okay, great. And been telling this... And so this story just evolved from this one time when we went away and forgot to bring books. Went away for the weekend, forgot to bring any kids' books, so I had to make up a story, and she wanted a story about cats, so I started this story about Catsville. And then she just wanted that every night. Like, we'd read her books and then she'd want the next update of Catsville, and she would always dictate the plot.
I love this. I love this kid.
Yeah, and anything that didn't work in her life, she would resolve in Catsville.
Okay.
So when she didn't want to go to daycare, which was on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday, in Catsville, Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday all got old and died.
What?
So it just went from Sunday to Thursday. So the cat in Catsville didn't have to go to daycare anymore.
She has a strong sense of autonomy, your daughter, I'm guessing.
She does. And so then we created this book, and it took 2 years.
Yeah.
But now she's a co-author.
That's awesome.
You know, she's a co-author, and we create projects together about things that she wants to do, and they're obviously there. She's now 5, but they're projects that are appropriate for a 5-year-old, but it's still, what are we going to do together that's something that's over time, that's kind of building that muscle for her.
That's
cool.
Awesome.
Stuff that we get to do together.
That's really awesome. Did you apply the same principle to get to third Dan, black belt in Aikido?
I actually did have that. I had the, when I started, I said, I want to be a third Dan. I heard when I started, someone told me that 1 in 200 people who start get to a black belt.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, 1 in 200. Looked around the mat and went, okay, I'm the 1 in 200. And then created actually a project to get to third Dan by the age of 40. And I failed on that project. It took me till 42.
Are you planning to go? Because there's more than three Dans, right? There's more?
Yeah. My teacher, who's now dead, but was one of the original students of O-sensei who started Aikido, was an 8th Dan.
Yeah.
When Amy was born, I decided to take some time off of just training 3 times a week with two kids. 3-year-old and a baby wasn't really the thing. And 6 months later, I realized that I didn't miss it and that I didn't hurt anymore. Like, I was pain-free. And man, perhaps I'm getting too old for this. I'm doing yoga instead now.
Okay, that sounds much more gentle and zen. So I'm curious also, like one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is, and it's interesting you started with the podcast with this, you know, what's the inner game of productivity? And I said, what's the biggest mistake? And you said, people blame themselves, and then proceeded to say productivity is all about external instructors. Is that right? Or is there an inner game that we need to address as well? And if so, what do we do to deal with that?
Yeah, definitely there is an inner game. And it's not the low-hanging fruit. So I think there's kind of quick wins around external stuff. And absolutely there's, I think of it as kind of the 80-20 rule, like 20% is internal and let's work on that. And if you look at, you know, meditation and mindfulness has become kind of the flavor of the month, but the amount of successful people who are good at achieving long-term success and fulfilling on projects, the amount who have some kind of mindfulness practice is astounding. And I think that's a way of, like, that's one of the things you can do to win the inner game and quieten the voices that are going to tell you that you're not able to do it, that it's not about, that it's, yeah, that it is your fault.
So let's talk about the Ishaya. How do you pronounce it? Ishaya monk practice, because I'm trained basic level in the Ishaya practice. You introduced me to this meditation methodology. You've been doing it for how long?
I did the initial course 5 or 6 years ago. Yeah. But 3.5 years, a bit more than 3.5 years since I went to Spain, and I've been doing it seriously.
Okay. So people are going to be curious, what does it mean to be a monk? Do you not have sex anymore? Is obviously what people are going to want to know. Now, we don't need the detail. I just need a yes or no answer to that question. And then what does it involve, and how has that helped your productivity? Not the sex part, but the...
So there are three elements. So I've got a relationship with my teacher. It's like a spiritual teacher.
Yeah.
A lifelong relationship. I have a meditation practice. So I've... For the last 3.5 years, a bit more, I've meditated for at least an hour every day.
Is that in one sitting, or do you divide it up?
No, divide it up.
So you do three sessions of 20?
Two or three sessions, yeah.
Wow. Yep.
Ideally three, but sometimes the middle one, depending on my day, that one doesn't always happen, and then I just go a bit longer at night.
Yep.
And... the third is I've taken vows, and so these are vows of telling the truth and non-violence, and one of them is self-restraint, which is the Sanskrit is parigraha, and that was different, translated differently from the Sanskrit. So some orders translate that as celibacy.
Mm-hmm.
We translated as self-restraint, which is much better.
Oh, well, I'm down with that.
and so one of our rules, if you like, is that we don't have sex outside of a committed relationship.
Okay.
But within a marriage, I'm all good.
Okay. So that's why did you decide to become a monk? Like, so why did you take the vows, and why did you subscribe to this? So, like, yes, there's a benefit to productivity. Is there anything else that feeds into it? What made you choose to do this?
Yeah, no, it wasn't about the benefit to productivity. That wasn't the driving motivation. It almost felt like not a decision. It was when I was in that environment, and there was the... So I was on a one-month retreat, and... that was when I asked Maharishi to be my teacher. The first time I was on a one-month retreat. And it was having a look at the two kind of paths that my life could take, either having this practice or not. And the one that called me, if you like, was definitely having this as a practice.
Mm.
And then given that, I was going to be all in. I didn't want to do this. And for me, it's easier to doing it all in. If I have a teacher and I've taken these vows, then it's not a decision anymore. This is now, all right, that's the rest of my life is done. I don't need to think about that anymore. It's like I'm married. That's a lifelong commitment. I don't have to now think about who am I going home with, or who, like, that's all done. There's no more mind space taken up with that.
Mm-hmm. So what have you noticed in your life and world since you made this lifelong commitment to the Ishaya practice?
I think the main thing is from the meditation practice. And it is it's a practice that's about building the muscle of being more present. So noticing when I sit and have my closed eye meditation, it's consciously noticing when my mind goes into the future or into the past and bring it back to the present. But exercising that muscle then in the rest of my life makes me more present. So I'm more present as a dad. I'm more present as a husband. I'm more present as a thought leader. And then my thinking is better and my speaking is better. And life is just kind of better, being more in the present moment.
Mm. Yep. It sounds like a huge benefit to me. That's why I continue to practice.
How's your practice going?
I'm once a day, 20 minutes.
Nice.
More often than not. So that's I've maintained a practice. I've been trying to work in Qigong practice following the meditation practice as well. So I'm sort of, I think I need to put that into a project. Build the habit more. So that's sort of what I'm building in terms of developing mindfulness and calming the mind down. And I've noticed, like, it's been, I think, 2 or 3 years since I've been doing my meditation practice. And physiologically, what I've noticed, because I check my HRV at the same time as I'm meditating, my heart rate variability, which is an indicator of resilience of your nervous system, is my heart rate's gone down, my nervous system strength has gone up. And because I do it over 20 minutes, I notice it shows the drop. After 10 minutes, whoomp, my system is way more relaxed. And for the first year, that didn't happen. It just kind of stayed scattered. So now I can go into that state, and I've got the proof, the measurability of it in my app that I use. So I've noticed that just from external resources, but from my inner practice, it's just like a little reprieve and just a settling. And I know the busier I am, the more important it is to do it. Even for 10 minutes is to get some sort of settling, because I think you're right, that muscle gets developed. And so you can get to that state a lot more quickly. Has it helped with my productivity? I'm not sure. I think so. You know, I'm a highly productive person as well. Like I really work on executing and delivering on my projects. I think what it's helped though is just started to take the anxiety out of stuff. I think that's been a project I've been working on for some time, is to get less out of the head and be present in all things. Absolutely. So Pete, I'm going to ask this question. I know we're getting close to time. One of the vows is speaking the truth. And you and I had a separate conversation around a business matter of mine a while ago, about a month or so ago. And I asked you at the end, okay, Pete, thanks for all that structural stuff. What would you do? And you said, I would speak the truth, basically, was the answer. That has really stayed with me in terms of living up to that bar. And it's not that easy to live by that standard. Can you speak a little bit about what that means to you and what you found easy and hard about that?
Yeah. Once you actually take a vow to tell the truth, what you notice is all the places that you automatically don't.
Yeah.
So I was at the gym. I was at the gym this morning, and Gaz, my trainer, says to me, oh, can you say hi to Trish for me? And in the past, I'd say, sure. And maybe I would or maybe I wouldn't. And then I actually consciously thought about, how do I answer that question? Can you say hi to Trish for me? And if I'm going to actually promise, then I'm going to have to track it. I'm not going to count. I can't say yes and just rely on my memory. And then if I'm going to track it, what I need to do is get out my phone and make a note and say, Gaz, say hi to Trish. And then I think, well, if I'm going to do that, I may as well just text her, because that's just as easy. And bloody hell, if I'm going to text her, well, he could just text her. And so what I said to him like that is, oh, I might. If I remember, I will.
Yeah.
And now it's like this ongoing joke that he, whenever he says, say hi to Trish, I'll say, yeah, I might. Might do. So there's this, okay, and so there's this kind of consciousness and knowing, noticing, okay, what, having, paying more attention to what comes out of my mouth and noticing where an automatic lie just, again, I remember with coming out of a supermarket, and a couple of years ago when Scarlett wanted to play on the like the thing that sits outside the supermarket that you put $2 in and it goes round and round. And I had like the shopping and it was hot and I was trying to get her to go, and she was saying, and she said, "Come on, can I play this?" And I'm like, "No, it's broken. Come on, let's go." And I'm like, oh, where did that come from? Like, there was no, like, just the lie was so easy. And I think how it, so there's a rigor that comes from, all right, I'm actually going to be conscious of what comes out of my mouth and not allow lies. And even like in the conversation we talked about, if there's a consequence, even if it's difficult, I'm still going to tell the truth. And how that, I think, translates into productivity is I now have a really high level of trust for myself. That if I say this is going to happen, it's going to happen. And it means, like, it's great. People around me know, it's kind of been trained, if I say this is what's going to happen, they kind of all line up for that, because that's how people relate to me, is that I tell the truth, and when I say this is going to happen, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And when I declare a project, when I say this is what we're going to do, then I relate to that like that's the truth. Like that's, there's some strength to my promise and to my word.
What I've noticed since we had that conversation, because I really processed that deeply and took that principle to my engagements, and it, what you think is hard is actually, it makes life easier if you commit to speak the truth, because you don't have these tentacles of crap hanging off you, you know, where you're like fudged things around the edges and there's a little residual of guilt and worried if you're going to be found out or whatever. It's like all that stuff goes.
Yeah, and you don't have to remember, okay, if I told what to or what did that. Yeah.
I don't think I've told lies like that. Maybe I have. Wait a minute. I probably have, if I'm speaking the truth. In any case, committing to not doing that and to being honest and above board just makes things so much cleaner. You know, there's no repercussive things. You just show up as authentically as you can, making the decision that you believe is right with the best of what you know at the time. And does that make productivity better? Yeah. But I think more importantly, it makes you and your life better.
Yeah. One of the nice things that my teacher said about this too is, like he said, always tell the truth, but he said you can tell the kind truth.
Yeah.
So, well, we had this example when I was at the meditation retreat, and I was having a great time, and I was saying, oh, this is like, I thought I would really miss home, but I'm actually really just enjoying being here. And he said, the kind truth is if Trish says, do you miss me? You don't have to say no. I'm having a great kind truth is to say, I love you, babe. I'm really looking forward to seeing you again.
That's called deflection. He calls it a kind truth. There you go. That's a political sidestep. Yeah.
Yes.
I call them poo bombs, you know, like you can speak the truth and you can do it like you just dump something on the table and it splatters everywhere, or you can be kind in the delivery. And that takes presence. That takes the ability to be centered, to be able to do that. Hence meditation key. Pete, we're going to have to wrap it up. That was delightful. Thank you so much for carving out space in your calendar to be here with me to share your wisdom.
My absolute pleasure. Honored to be your 68th podcast.
Yes. You know what? I think you
might. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
I think you might actually be episode 69. So you might even get the magic number 69. I'll check on that for you.
That would be a double honor.
Thanks, Pete.